You are listening to Absent Minded, brought to you by HabsEyesOnThePrize.com. Hello and welcome to Absent Minded. My name is Jared Book. We continue our look toward the 2023 draft. Joining me today is Matt Drake, and we have a special guest as well today from The Athletic. It's Scott Wheeler. We'll start with Scott. Scott, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. As you guys know, this is crunch time. Just got back from a few days at the Combine in Buffalo, and now sort of twiddling my fingers and finishing up my my last sort of bits of content that are going to roll out before the draft, and then it's off to Nashville. So I'm looking forward to putting a bow on this draft class. And then a day later, I'll be thinking about Macklin Celebrini.
I was going to say, have you started your 2024 prep yet?
We've put out one list. I've got a very, very, very early list out at The Athletic from a couple of months ago. And then I'll have another one probably in August. I typically do like a preseason one. So I'll probably have a new one in August that I'll have to start chipping away at. And we'll have the Hlinka Gretzky Cup in August as well, which features a bunch of those guys, obviously. So that's sort of next on the calendar.
Yeah, obviously we'll talk about the draft, but with a slant towards the Canadians. But also that might be the most interesting part of the entire draft as well, because there seems to be a consensus top five. You know, your rankings had, you know, Connor Bedard in tier one, and then four guys at tier two. And in most cases, that would make picking at five a good thing. But in other cases, it seems like, you know your colleagues at The Athletic, Arpin Basu, wrote yesterday that the Canadians have been rumored of trading up, or trying or inquiring about trading up. There has been a lot of discussion about how they're not taking Richkov. You know, Kent Hughes has been like adamant that, you know, yeah, there are concerns with the contract and things like that. There seems to be a lot of smoke and information out there with the Canadians. What do you make of so much noise coming out of that, you know, as we head into the draft?
Well, I think there are two ways to read it. The first would just be to accept that it doesn't seem like they're going to take Michkov, and that they appear to be sort of tilting towards another direction. And then the second, if you're a conspiracy theorist, is, okay, if they're doing all of this talking, maybe it's a professional. I mean, you talked about smoke. Maybe it's a smoke screen, right? Maybe this is some extremely professional, extremely high level, extremely convincing smoke screening that's happening, and they're just going to take him in the end. So I think it's much more likely that it's the former, and that the part of the reason they're considering trading up is because they just don't feel comfortable with the risk that comes with Matvei Michkov and the contract and the geopolitical situation between Russia and Ukraine and everything about it. And even beyond that, I think an important layer of this that doesn't get discussed enough is not just that you have to wait three seasons for him to come over here, but that in the meantime, you're not likely to be involved whatsoever, or at least in a very limited manner, in his development. And I think that the Montreal Canadiens would be more inclined to take Matvei Michkov if they could come to some sort of an arrangement with Ska that says we get to come over there and spend a little bit of time with him throughout the year and that kind of a thing. And I just don't get the sense from St. Petersburg that that's something that they're comfortable with. They won't want whichever team drafts Michkov to be meddling in the development process. And that piece of it, I think, is extremely important, because the Montreal Canadiens want to be involved with whoever they pick. They want to have it's less about a say and more about just influence and a relationship and sort of bring that player along. And that piece of it in the 3 years that he's over there, it just isn't likely to be a major factor. You're not probably going to get to spend much time with him and sort of have an influence in that process. So you won't know until you get him over here what he's going to look like. I think for me, I would make the argument that regardless of whether they're involved in that process, he's going to be just fine. And he's going to come over here and be a star player probably immediately. But that's not a sort of easy proposition if you're the Montreal Canadiens either. And you've got this premium asset that not only you have to wait for, but you can't be involved in the interim.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point, because and something that I thought about myself is that it's not even like there's going to be like when you have guys, and let's say they take a Will Smith or a Ryan Leonard, they're going to the NCAA in all likelihood. You at least know they're going to have big roles there, right? And with a team like Scott, there's no guarantee that he's going to get, top 6 minutes, especially early on. He might get loaned to a team like Sochi again, where the development isn't as the environment isn't as conducive. So I mean, yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty, not just within the contract, but not having even a certainty about what kind of role they're going to play with the KHL team, right?
Yeah, that's part of it. I do think that he's so talented that what happened last year isn't likely to repeat itself. I mean, they saw him go there and lead that team in scoring, and I fully expect that he'll come back and play on PP1 and play in Ska's top six. And if he doesn't, then you do have to worry. But they're obviously notoriously slow with that process over there in terms of giving players opportunity. He does feel like he should be an exception to that rule, though. And I'd be not shocked if he were back where he was last year, where they just weren't giving him enough looks. But I would probably be a little bit surprised if he's not an impact guy for them next year.
Yeah, and you mentioned the relationship with Ska, and it's kind of interesting because the Canadians do have a connection to Ska, right? Nick Bobrov spent 3 years there as their director of North American scouting. His father was a scout there for a lot of years as well. You'd kind of think that the uncertainty is not something that Montreal would be afraid of, because you think that they'd have a pretty good idea of what's going on. So, do you think that the question, like the concern, is more just not having that control? Like, they have a pretty good idea of what's going to go on there, right? Like, the uncertainty is not something that would scare them in this case. Do you agree with that?
No, but I think the certainty that they do have may have led them to the conclusion that he's maybe not as complete a player as everybody thinks, so that there's question marks there about him. That certainty is an asset to them in that it allows them to likely learn more about who he is and what he's all about. And there is, not to go back to the smoke analogy, but there is smoke about, I've heard this from several scouts with multiple different organizations, there is smoke about him mouthing off at the coaching staff earlier this year and pouting in practices, and all of that stuff was happening. And part of the reason he sort of forced his way out of Ska so that he could go play with Sochi was because him and the coaching staff there were sort of in a pretty tense situation by the sounds of it. So yeah, there maybe they've got concerns. Maybe they've heard from Ska about sort of attitude issues, and I don't think that's a make or break thing with him. He's obviously been a captain for the Russian national team across events, and he's got a lot on his shoulders in terms of expectations and all of that. So I can definitely sympathize with the kid for sure. But some teams are probably less comfortable than others with when they hear stuff like that. And I don't think it's not like what Ryan Merkley in his draft year had going on, for example, where he was a complete loose cannon all the time. But they're definitely it didn't go well for him in Ska to start last year. And I'm sure if they're well connected there, they've heard all about that.
Yeah, it seems to me that what the Canadians are going to be doing their homework here. It's not going to be like they're just going to be like, oh, Russia, we're scared, we don't know anything. It's going to be the opposite, where if they don't take him, it's because they know something that maybe makes it less of an obvious pick. And listen, there's parallels to this, right? Last year, heading into the draft, everyone's like, yeah, they're picking Shane Wright. Like, there's no question there. And then as you got further and further into the draft, it's, maybe they're not going to take Shane Wright. So the conventional wisdom and the conventional pick is not something that, in this short period that we've seen from the Kent Hughes administration. Something else that Kent Hughes said, and I want to get your take on this a little bit, is, he said at the draft after they picked Slafkovský last year that 25-foot-8 players don't scare him. A 5-foot-8 player doesn't scare him, but 25-foot-8 players scare him. And the Canadians are in a position where they do have, if you Cole Caulfield is definitely going to be a mainstay in their top six. You might have a guy like Sean Farrell who might sneak in there. You have a guy like Lane Hudson who's going to come up there. Do you think that, in, when you look at guys in that range, and Michkov is one of them, and Zach Benson is probably another one in that range where he's a little bit smaller or shorter than the other guys. Do you think that that's a concern where people are trying to pinpoint where Montreal might go at five?
Yeah, it's definitely a worthwhile talking point. I mean, even on top of those guys you mentioned, and these guys may not make it, but Philip Meschar is not a big kid either, right? So you go down the list, it's there's a number of them in the system. So it's a piece of the puzzle. Even guys like Jordan Harris aren't the biggest kids. So there's you already start to add them up, and then suddenly you've got seven, eight guys that are on the smaller side. And I'm not the type, I'm sure you've read my work, I'm not the type that's all that concerned about that. I think good players are good players, and you got to keep your focus there, and you can figure out the other stuff down the line. But in saying that, I'm sure it's something that they're thinking about. And yet I've heard them tied to players like, and this is might be a little breaking news here, but I've heard them tied to players like Andrew Kristall. And I think if Andrew Kristall slips into the second round, that they could conceivably use their early second round pick on a guy like that. So I still don't, I think they're cognizant of it in terms of just in terms of how many guys they have that look like that. But I think push comes to shove, they still are a team that recognizes that, okay, if there's a value gap here, we need to just keep taking those guys and sort of figure out adding a little bit of size to the roster down the line. And they've got a little bit of that too. I mean, we all know what Dak and Slafkovsky and those guys look like as well. So it's not like certainly we know what Arbor Jacki looks like too. So it's not like they don't have any of that. But I'm sure it's something that's in the back of their head, especially after last year, where they chose after Slafkovsky chose a number of guys, so including the Tourigny kid who went over and played in Slovakia, right? So yeah, there's I'm sure it's going to be a part of their process, maybe to go about it a little bit differently this year.
The director of analytics, Christopher Boucher, was on their behind the scenes draft video saying, okay, if we take Slafkovský because of his size, does that mean we don't have to think about size for the rest of the draft? And then you saw that with Tourigny and Lane Hudson, and they definitely don't shy away from it. They give Caulfield a big contract as well, so it's not like it scares them. And I wonder if maybe they pick somebody like a Leonard or a Reinbacher at five, and then like you mentioned, take a swing with their late first or early second. I don't think they'll keep both of those picks. I think one of them's likely out the door. But you have guys like Kristall, guys like Gavin Brindley and Bradley Nato who might be available in that range where you can take a bigger swing as well. Matt, do you have anything to jump in with right now?
Well, I kind of wanted to, because you're mentioning some of the smaller players, the concern over taking the smaller players. I wonder, is this something that the Habs should even really be worried about at this point? You look particularly at the center position, right? Who do they have right now? They got Nick Suzuki, not the biggest guy, but definitely not small. He's over 200 pounds. And we saw him last year, bullying some people on the ice. They've got Kirby Doc. Christian Dvorak is there for the time being. And then you also have Pierre-Luc Dubois, who has basically all but announced that he's going to be a Montreal Canadian at some point. Why would we be concerned about going after one of the bigger centers? I feel like this is going to be a Dylan Strome, Mitch Marner situation. If we take Will Smith or Ryan Leonard, sure, it fills maybe that perceived need at the time being. But then we're overlooking a guy like Zach Benson. And I really feel like, again, nothing against Dylan Strome, nothing against Will Smith, nothing against Ryan Leonard. I feel like this is something where a couple of years down the road, we're going to look back at it and go, well, that dynamic playmaker who happens to be extremely good at both ends of the ice might have been the guy that we should have gone with, regardless of his size. So I'm wondering, Scott, what do you think about that? Like, do you think this is an actual need for the Habs, or do you think that this is just them kind of looking down the list of guys that they've got and going, well, we've got a few guys that are too small, and maybe we're actually addressing a need that's not really there necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't worry too much about it. Ultimately, push comes to shove, I would take wherever I have them. I would take an Andrew Kristall and a Zach Benson. I mean, I've got Benson sixth on my list, right? So, and I think the Habs should treat it no differently. Just because they've taken a few guys like that doesn't mean they need to sort of stop there. So, You need to find talent. You can find, I say this all the time, you can find the 6'2", 220-pound third line winger in free agency for a couple of million bucks every year. Like we just saw the Vegas Golden Knights win the cup, and they've got Carrier and guys that weren't didn't have cachet or notoriety and were signed for cheap and are excellent at, like, Carrier is one of the best bottom six players in the league. And they acquired him at basically no cost. Right. So you can do that. You cannot find more of the Nick Suzuki's or the Cole Caulfields doing that. Right. So I'm all for making that a priority at the draft. I would say, just on your Will Smith note, that I think Will Smith is the borderline the most purely skilled player in this draft with the puck on his stick. So I don't think you're sacrificing anything there in terms of taking him over Zach Benson. But certainly if it's a conversation between Zach Benson and anyone else who's not from that top five, I mean, the way he plays, his versatility, how quick he is to get up and under sticks, his playmaking, the two-way game, he's one of the best two-way forwards in the draft. All of that it's legit. And just because he's 160 pounds, I don't think in his case makes it any less legit. I think if he were a passive player, one of those players who wasn't sort of in the mix and everything that happens on the ice, then sure, you start to question, okay, how involved can this kid be? But that's not Zach Benson. Zach Benson played on a team with 6'4" Connor Geeky this year and was involved in twice as many board battles as him. Right. So, he's fearless out there. He's sort of that competitive smaller player. And then on top of that has all the skill that you'd expect. So, Benson's he's going to be interesting because it's always those guys that fall. That's just the bottom line. Teams, push comes to shove, teams tend to prioritize centers and defensemen at the top of the draft, and it's always the smaller wingers that fall. So I would not be surprised. I know everybody likes Zach Benson. He's a beloved player in the scouting community because of the way he plays. But in saying that, I still would not be surprised if he falls out of the top 10, if only because teams are going to prioritize the premium positions there.
That's actually a good segue, because, you know, a couple of names that we hear a lot about that really are outside of the top five with the Canadians is Ryan Leonard and David Reinbacher. And Leonard, the buzz started even before the U18s. And then during the U18s, it kind of became, you know, he became one of the players that really stood out a little bit. Maybe, you know, distancing himself from, or at least maybe putting him closer in the range of his two line mates. And you're really high on Gabe Perreault as well, and we'll get into that a little bit. But, you know, if you had Ryan Leonard at 11, David Reinbacher at 12. Are these, I don't want to say they're safe picks, because they're still very good players, even as you get down to that range. But is what could you expect out of those two guys, and what makes them out, you know, what keeps them from being in that top five, I would say? What's the things that they don't have that maybe the other players do?
Yeah, it's a good question. First of all, I always like to preface this by saying that 11 and 12, even though I'm a slightly lower on them than the consensus, that still means that I believe those two players are excellent players, especially in a draft class as strong as this one. So I think the world of both of those kids for very different reasons. Reinbacher, in terms of your question of ceiling and what he could be, he's not, I think there are going to be several, even outside of those top five guys, there are going to be several sort of 70 plus point players that come out of this draft. That's just the quality of the talent that exists at forward. I think it's going to look a lot like 2015 that way, where in 2015, you obviously had Mitch Marner and Jack Eichel and Connor McDavid, but you also had Mikko Rantanen and Brock Besser and Matt Barzell and Travis Konecny and Sebastian Aho, who were taken much lower, right? I think this draft is going to look similarly to that. And I'm not sure he's going to be one of those guys, but I think the expectation for Leonard would be that if you get a 50 to 60 point player who scores 25 to 30 goals and is one of the most competitive, sort of hardest working players in the league while he plays like that, then suddenly you've got an extremely impressive player. Like, there's a reason that teams love the Tyler Toffolis of the league, right? The competitive scorers who can give you 50 or 60 points and play on your first line, but maybe aren't going to lead your team in scoring kind of thing. So I think that's what you have to envision out of Leonard. He's a very strong kid. He's a very stocky kid for 5'11", sort of 6 foot, not the tallest kid in the world, but a really impressive athlete who, like, you run into him at the rink, you tell right away that he's a muscular kid. Can obviously rip the puck, extremely competitive, one of the most competitive players in the draft. And has really good skill in terms of his hands as well. He's not just the push and pop shooter. He can make plays for himself. He showed, as this year progressed, a little bit more creativity. I don't think that's ever going to be the hallmark of his game, but he did show some more playmaking. And I think Will Smith and Gabe Perreault kind of brought that out of him a little bit, and he couldn't tunnel vision as much with them on the ice because they were just so good at getting open for him as well. So lots of progress this year, very good player. And maybe if he's a 50 or 60 point player, his total impact on the game is still higher than a kid who's comes out of this draft and is giving you 70 points. Right. So I think that's what they imagine. I think they want more scoring. I think they want to add a little bit of a competitive edge to their sort of top six, top nine group. And that's what he would, in theory, provide. Rheinbacher is an interesting one because Rheinbacher, outside of Connor Bedard and maybe Adam Fantilli, is probably the closest to NHL ready. He's one of only three players. Those are really the only three players who could conceivably play NHL games next year. He's done it in the Swiss National League, which is an extremely good league now. I think it's very important to stress that. That league is better than the Finnish Liga. They pay higher salaries than the Finnish Liga. And it's a better league than the German DEL. I would say that really outside of Sweden and Russia, that's the best league in Europe right now. So for him to play big minutes there, to do it against men and former NHL players is no small thing. And the question there is, okay, this guy looks like a safe projection as a 6'2", 20 minutes a night defenseman who can play in your top four, give you 35, 40 points a year, be a sort of really good number two, number three defenseman. The question there is, can he find a little bit more offense, a lot like Jake Sanderson and Moritz Seider did after their draft years? Can he find a little bit more offense and then emerge as kind of more of a power play guy and more of a point producer? And then suddenly you're in the number one defenseman conversation. I think that's less likely, just to sort of, if you're familiar with his game, he's a very smart player. He's got good skill. He skates well. All of that's true, but there isn't a lot of dimension to his game offensively, and he doesn't have a big shot. So there are a couple of things there that will maybe keep him from becoming a true number one. But if you get a number two defenseman out of fifth or sixth overall, that's still a good pick. So that's the calculation that they're going to make is, okay, if this guy can become a sort of consistent 21, 22 minute a night guy who can play in all situations for us, is that worthy of passing up on a high end forward? And it's a conversation that I think all of those teams in that sort of 5 to 8 range are going to be having.
Yeah.
So quick follow-up on Rheinbacher though, because the Habs have been linked to him. Do you think they need to reach for him at 5, or would they hypothetically be able to trade down? Like, how much interest is there legitimately inside of the top 10 in Rheinbacher? Could they conceivably move down to 9 or 10, still get him, and then stack some more assets if that's what they really want to do instead of reaching for him at 5?
Not likely, if only because we know that Arizona has taken forwards consecutively with all of their high picks, right? They took 3 years ago, they took Dylan Guenther. Last year, they took Connor Geeky and Logan Cooley. They've just gone forward pretty consistently at the top of the draft. And I think there would be a lot of appeal in Arizona to take a sort of premium defenseman here. That doesn't mean it's a foregone conclusion. I know that Arizona is really high on Dalibor Dvorsky, and I think they're strongly considering him at 6 as well, even if Rheinbacher's there. But between the risk of Arizona taking him 6, and then again, I would add Philly to that mix at 7. Philly has, I mean, Keith Jones has made it clear since being hired as president in Philadelphia, the very first thing he said in one of his very first interviews was, we're going to build this team from the back end out. That's what I believe in. And we're going to, if we win a Stanley Cup, it's going to be because we have 6 excellent defensemen kind of thing. So I think they're going to make that a big, big priority in Philadelphia. And he's obviously the guy in this draft. So I think if you're looking to trade back to 8 or 9 with Washington or Detroit, that the reality is that he's probably just not going to be there, which puts them again in such a weird little wedge at fifth overall.
Yeah, it's funny listening to you talk about Reinbacher. It's kind of similar to the way that people talked about Caden Gooley leading up to his draft, and he didn't maybe
Yeah, I
add as
think.
much offense as Sider and Sanderson, but there's a conversation where he kind of raised his profile a bit after his draft year, right?
Yeah, I think Caden's a little more physical than Reinbacher. Plays a more of a stand-up style, if you will, defensively. Reinbacher's more of a stick-on-stick guy kind of thing. But yeah, there's some similarities then there. I think you would hope if you're taking Reinbacher at five that he becomes a better player than Caden Gooley, and Caden Gooley is obviously a very good player. But yeah, there's the similarities, some similarities there.
The thought of penciling in those two guys for, 10 years in your top four is pretty
Yeah.
tempting, I think, for any GM to have those guys kind of penciled in and not have to worry about them. And I was surprised a bit that you mentioned that Reinbacher's upside was so high, because he's kind of seen as kind of this kind of, like you mentioned, NHL ready. But there still seems to be a little bit of potential for growth offensively, even if that's not as likely as maybe some of the other players as well. We're going to take a quick break here, and we'll come back with Scott Wheeler after a word from some sponsors.
The God of Mischief is back and better than ever.
Loki.
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 Loki. Wow. Great to see you again.
Critics agree Loki season two is
marvelous.
Great. And it's finally here.
How much do you know?
Let's assume I don't know much.
A mind-bending adventure. Spectacularly cinematic.
I've been waiting for a moment like this.
It surpasses all expectations.
A little over the top, don't you think?
I thought it was spot on.
Loki season two, now streaming only on Disney Plus.
All right, so we talked about what will happen likely at number five with the Canadians. I want to talk about a little bit about Gabe Perreault, because I'm sure you've noticed that you're probably a little higher on him than other places leading up to the draft. What is it about his game that you like so much?
Well, I think that it all starts and ends with two things. One, inside the offensive zone, he's probably the highest sort of, I hate the term hockey IQ, but he's probably the sort of highest IQ offensive zone player in the draft. So the way, I mean, certainly Connor Bedard, Matvei Michkov are up there, Will Smith's up there, but he sees, even relative to those guys, he sees the game at a more advanced level. I would add Jaden Perron is probably in there. Luca Cagnoni, the defenseman out of Portland, is probably up there. But Gabe's that classic sort of eyes in the back of your head, Daniel and Henrik Sedin type of sort of spatial awareness on the ice. The number of plays he made this year where he found a guy in space with a perfect pass on the weak side of coverage, or the sort of blind spin pass or the little drop pass between his legs to someone who hadn't even been calling for the puck, or finding players when they don't even expect to be found with passes that they then bobble because he's getting pucks to them when they're not even ready to have pucks come to them, kind of thing. It's pretty unbelievable to watch. And then on top of that, the second piece that I sort of hinted at is his hands also get an extremely high grade. So his ability to break guys down one-on-one, to hang onto the puck inside the offensive zone, to sort of slip in and out of holes, also extremely, extremely high end. The question with Gabe is, and if you've ever bumped into him, you quickly realize is he's a really skinny kid, right? So similar to how Kent Johnson was in his draft year, similar to how Elias Pettersson in Vancouver was heading into his draft year. He was like 120, 130 pounds when he showed up to the national program. He's now up these, I think he's like 5'11" and 170 pounds kind of thing now. So he's not tiny. But you can tell when you run into him that he's just a kid who needs to get a little bit stronger. And I think that's the big factor with him is sort of that strength, what it will mean for his skating. I think his skating has been knocked a little bit too hard. I actually think he's a much better skater than people give him credit, and like basically an average skater, if you will. Yeah, if he gets a little bit quicker and a little bit stronger, suddenly you have an extremely exciting offensive player. I also liked the growth of his game defensively there this year. He tracked back and sort of lifted and stole a ton of pucks with that team this year as the season progressed. And I think teams took note of that at U18 Worlds, the number of times that he tracked back and, you know, sort of stole a puck off someone and then made a play back the other way that resulted in a goal, kind of a thing. So there's a lot to like, but the real calling card of Gabe is, no question, is just his sort of feel for the game offensively.
And, you know, you mentioned this in your look at how you scout and what you look for. How hard is it really to separate line mates, especially with the U.S. development program, where, you know, the best players are going to play together. And we've seen some teams kind of, you know, read too much into it. I mean, I think Cole Caulfield, there's a size factor there, but there's a lot of talk that, you know, his goals were pretty much just because of Jack Hughes, or mostly because of Jack Hughes. And then you have other guys that were, you know, a guy like Alex Turcotte, who is still coming into his own from that same team. How do you separate, especially guys on that U.S. development program, where their teammates are and line mates are so good as well, and you know, so many of them are in top 15. How do you kind of separate that? What's the challenge there?
Yeah, it's definitely a factor that you're always wondering about which of those three is going to bust, which of those three is going to look like they were carried along once they're separated from them. Obviously, in their scenario, it's that we're not even going to get a chance to see that at the next level because they're all going to college together. So it's difficult. You have to be cognizant of how much those guys are all propping each other up. I think in Gabe's sort of, for Gabe specifically, for a long time he was viewed as kind of a late first round pick, and then it just became impossible and late first round pick because of that. I think because everybody felt that Will was the more talented player and that Ryan was the real driver on that line. And then eventually, if you're leading those guys in scoring all year and you're the one breaking the records, then you have to start to ask different questions about, okay, who really is making all the plays on this line? And on many nights, it felt like Gabe was the guy who was making all the plays on that line. So I think with those three, the skill level of each has sort of distinguished itself over time. That isn't always the case. There were similar questions last year, though, about, okay, is Logan Cooley propping up Jimmy Snuggerud and Cutter Gauthier? And then lo and behold, Cutter Gauthier and Jimmy Snuggerud had two of the best post-draft seasons in that draft class and proved to everybody that maybe it wasn't Logan Cooley and maybe they're legit players in their own right. So it can go both ways. Certainly there are times where players get revealed after the fact to be for it to have been a little bit of a mirage. I think that certainly happened with that unbelievable age group with Matt Boldy and Cole Caulfield and Trevor Zegras and Alex Turcotte and all those guys, especially in Turcotte's case, although injuries have played a big factor in Turcotte's development. But it's something you can't ignore it. It's also relevant at the other end of the spectrum with a player like Oliver Moore in this draft class, where you have to recognize that even though he had whatever it was, 71 points in 60 something games, that Oliver Moore was doing that playing primarily with Danny Nelson and Ryan Fine for most of the year, and then a little bit of the year with Cole Eiserman and James Haggins, who are extremely talented players but are ultimately underagers on that team. And in that role where he's not on PP1, he was a driver and he was still producing. And you have to, in your mind, ask yourself, okay, if you swapped Oliver Moore and Will Smith lines, what would that look like for the two of them? And I think the answer is that Oliver Moore would have been extremely productive. Obviously, he might not have had 120 something points like Will Smith, but I think it's clear that that line would have also been a nightmare to stop. So it's tricky both ways, both in terms of the guys who get all of that opportunity and play together and get to give each other gimmies like they did this year, and then also at the other end of the spectrum for the guys lower down the lineup of, okay, who's going to break out? And there's always one from that team as well. I mean, look at what Devin Kaplan did last year at BC, right, where he was a fourth line player at the program and then went to BC and was excellent as a freshman there. So there's always guys like that sort of sneak up and surprise you from that team too, because they were playing on the fourth line and they didn't get power play time. And they were then drafted in the fourth or fifth round. And then they're actually revealed to be sort of pretty talented players in their own right too. So especially at the national program, it's tricky. But we've run into similar challenges with some of the London Knights teams over the years, and the lack of opportunities that young players on those teams get. Connor McMichael's a classic example of a kid who hardly played in his draft year until late in the season, because that's what the Hunter brothers do. And then in his post-draft season had 100 points and was on the World Junior team, right? So, same with this Winnipeg Ice team the last couple of years with Benson and Savoy and Geeky, and they went out and traded for Zach Ostapchuk. And you always have to wonder, okay, those guys are the Harlem Globetrotters out there against the bad teams in those leagues, and you got to be cognizant of that as well. And on the flip side of it, you've got a Nate Danielson playing for the Brandon Wheat Kings who had nobody around him, right? So it can go both ways for sure.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, you know, when you watch Nick Suzuki and Junior, especially before getting, you know, before he was traded, he was making plays. You can tell when some players are just like, they just need someone who's better around them, because they're making plays that, you know, some people just don't see as well. And you mentioned that a little bit with Gabe Perreault as well, right? Where, you know, he make plays where other guys aren't even expecting a pass. And you kind of see that with some guys on teams that maybe aren't as good as well. And that's kind of the challenge, I guess, in scouting, is that there's so many variables, right? It's not like other sports where you're looking at, you know, maybe one or two leagues or three leagues. There's so many variables.
And it's not like the NHL where there's parity either, right? Right. So the guy who's point per game on one team and a guy who's point per game on another team could be two completely different levels of players. I made a point in my guide to scouting this year about how Cedric Yandon was more productive than Owen Beck last year in the OHL at basically the same birthday. But Gaindon was taken in the fourth round and Owen Beck was taken with the first pick of the second round. And that's because their production weren't equal and they were playing in different roles. And he had Luca Del Belbelouz on his team as well. And so there's layers to it for sure.
Yeah. That's actually a good transition, mentioning two Canadians prospects, because I do want to talk a little bit about some prospects, and Matt's going to enjoy this one, because I want to start off with Joshua Roy.
Yes.
He's somebody that you were really high on in his draft year, higher than almost anyone. And it's funny, because he has developed into, you know, probably what you thought, if not better. And he seems to be doing it in a way that's different than most prospects, right? You know, a lot of prospects kind of build on their strengths, and he seems to be just getting better everywhere. Like, his weaknesses are no longer weaknesses and things like that. So I just want to talk about him, what you saw in his draft year and what you've seen since
in him. Yeah, he's a fascinating case study for me. I appreciate you mentioning how high I was on him. But no, he's just a kid I spent a lot of time on. I watched him play for the very first time when I did a story on that Chevalier AAA team that he played for that went, whatever it was, 32 games unbeaten or whatever their ridiculous streak was in AAA. And I did a story on him and sort of got to know him through that process, and did a story on that team back then for The Athletic while they were on that win streak. And from there, just followed him really, really closely with St. John. I know the staff in St. John quite well and was in constant dialogue for his first couple of years, sort of as a property of their organization, in terms of just asking about him. And then it was interesting, right, where he requests a trade, which is pretty rare for a player of that notoriety, before they get drafted. He's not happy there. Part of not being happy there is that there was the pandemic and there were extreme restrictions in Eastern Canada and in the Maritimes, as we know. And as a result, people weren't allowed to travel into the Maritimes. So his family wasn't allowed to come visit him. And I think there was some loneliness happening, and then loneliness on top of being on a bad team. It's just not for everybody. And he basically, they sold him on, we're going to get the Memorial Cup. We're going to secure the Memorial Cup. By the time we're in the Memorial Cup, we're going to be one of the best teams in the league. And we want you to be one of our top six centers for when that happens. And I just think that through a little bit of immaturity at the time and just things not going exactly his way, that he didn't want to stick around for that. And as a result, once he requested the trade and ended up in Sherbrooke, there were questions about sort of his commitment and sort of the personality and all of that. And then the player was still the player deep down. There were also questions at the time about sort of his commitment off the puck. And I think what I saw when watching him was, A, he had this, even at a very young age in that league, and a very impressive ability to protect the puck, to sort of slow down his feet, keep defenders on his hips, and find ways to get from the boards to closer to the center of the ice to create good chances on goal. And at the time, they weren't all falling, but when you tuned into those Sea Dogs games, he was so impressive at getting shots on net and creating sort of looks from the middle third of the offensive zone. Even if he wasn't the quickest kid, you could see the talent. You could see that he was thinking out there offensively. You could see sort of puck protection skill. You could see the size and the frame that he was going to be able to fill out. There was just a lot to like about the player. And then even in Sherbrooke, I mean, he took on a bigger role and he was more impressive and sort of, I think, helped improve his stock a little bit there. But there were just enough questions for others that kept him sort of lower in the draft. And I think ultimately for me, the reason I kept him in my first round that year was just because I saw those puck protection tools. And I'm never all that worried about whether players can play defense when they're 17 years old, because that can come. We're seeing the same questions now about Edward Chalet in this draft and his commitment off the puck. And I mean, Phil Kessel just won his third Stanley Cup, right? They NHL players come in all shapes and sizes. You'd obviously like the vast majority of your players to be the really competitive types, but I don't necessarily believe that you need all 12 guys to be that. So I wasn't even worried about that. And then you're right that he's those have become strengths for him. He's now viewed as a penalty killer, and he's upped his sort of work rate and getting after pucks and using this the strength that he's added to win battles. And his playmaking has really sort of rounded out nicely. And now you've got a very, very complete player. He can play both center and the wing. And there's just, there are elements to his game and layers to his game that weren't there before. And I think that, not that it was predictable. I don't want to pat myself on the back too much that way, but because there were concerns, but I do think that the areas that he needed to grow in were areas that he was capable of growing in, that any player is capable of growing in. It wasn't the skill. He wasn't small. He didn't need to get more talented. He just needed to sort of figure things out there and grow up a little bit. And that's happened.
I can't agree with you more on that one. I've been watching him, particularly since he was drafted. I've been super high on him. I had him in my top five for the top 25 under 25 last year. We got a pretty good group this year, so it might be hard to keep him in there, but I don't see any reason why I wouldn't, because like you said, he's improved at everything. Like, his skating got better, and particularly the defense and the penalty killing aspect is huge for his NHL projection, because that's going to make him a lot more versatile. And for me, that was more important than the point production. I think a lot of Habs fans were looking at the point production this year and they're going, well, he's a little bit off from what he did last year. And for me, I don't care about his points going down a little bit in terms of points per game. For me, it was seeing that development on defense, that development of the penalty killing game. He was fantastic at the World Juniors on the penalty kill. Absolutely fantastic. And that, for me, was worth a lot more than the point production, because we know he can score. And we also know he's not going to score at the same rate in the NHL anyways. So he needed to develop some of those other aspects to get better, to increase his future projection in the NHL. And he did that. And I can't be more excited to see the kid turn pro next year. I'd love to see him with Laval for the first little bit and get an opportunity to kind of, you know, get his feet wet in the professional game. But I think he's going to push for a roster spot. I think he's going to make a tough decision for them at the end of camp, and I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
And you just had a really good piece on Jared Davidson in The Athletic, which is the story, it has a lot of similarities to a guy like Arvid Jacki. And it's funny because they were picked up by two different administrations. Obviously the scouts are similar, but the decision makers are different, but the stories are similar in the fact that, you know, no one saw these kids coming. They kind of just worked at it themselves and improved the areas that you can improve in the pandemic. And I think that that's something that a lot of things, you know, we talk about the lack of development time for a lot of these prospects, but it gave also some prospects the ability to improve their skating and focus on things like that, things you can do by yourself. Doing that story, what are your impressions on him? And obviously there's questions about, you know, he has to go pro this year. What are your impressions of him as a player and compared to, you know, maybe this time last year?
Yeah, I mean, obviously a great story as a kid who was undrafted into the WHL, And then walked on at his 16 year at no at 17 and basically walked on to his club, right? So unheard of, all but unheard of, basically, for that to happen. He wasn't listed by anybody. He was passed up twice in the WHL draft. He was cut from his midget AAA team in his post-bantam draft season in minor hockey. Got into Seattle through a relationship with the team's goalie coach, who was the sort of involved with his minor hockey team, and then beat out a bunch of second and third round picks as to sort of steal a roster spot and stick with the team. And then when undrafted in the NHL twice, his third crack at it, finally got picked after leading that team in scoring last year, then led them in scoring again this year. And now he's graduating from the WHL after having basically two back-to-back 40 goal, 90 point seasons, plus two excellent, excellent playoff runs, like 20 plus point playoff runs. In the WHL with a top team, right? And doing it as a centerman as well, as a top six center. So credit to him. Really interesting sort of player now. He's not the fastest kid, but he's not the tallest kid, but you see him and he's kind of 5'11", 6 feet, and he's really, really stocky, and he's got the sort of beard, and he looks bigger and stronger out there than everybody else. And he works extremely hard and wins his battles and can shoot the puck. I do wonder whether he tops out kind of as a call-up guy, right? Like the classic sort of good second line AHL player who works hard and elevates his line and can sort of do a little bit of everything and play in all situations, but maybe doesn't quite have sort of 82 games a year NHL upside. Like, I could see him becoming a guy who plays 10 or 15 NHL games a year for them, kind of thing, and becomes a depth piece for them. But even if he does that, that's every organization needs those guys. And it's a bonus when those guys are workers, right? And they'll take whatever role is given to them. And when they've got a backstory like his, it's, you sort of easy to cheer for, right? So I could see him becoming kind of a guy who rotates in and off of the fourth line. And if he's not with the NHL club, he's a sort of solid player, maybe wears a letter in the AHL and becomes a sort of part of the organization that way.
Yeah. The Canadians have a lot of guys like that. You know, and the one thing I noticed at the draft, the 2022 draft, is they had a type in that draft, right? Like not in shape and sizes, but in terms of personality. And you know, I'm sure that you spent some time with some of the guys in the OHL, like the Gaindals and the Roars and the Becks, and but they're just very confident. You know, Lane Hudson is in that group, Davidson, just guys who are very confident and kind of just put it all out there, and smart kids too, right? Like, it just it's interesting to me that all the guys in that draft, they're likely, very likely, not all going to make it in the NHL, but I wouldn't bet against any of them.
Yeah, no, I think that's a point well made. Certainly, I mean, I don't know how much Habs fans have got to know Vincennes, but if they haven't, they will. And he was easily, and I don't use this term lightly, but easily one of the sort of brightest lights in terms of the people I spoke to in last year's draft class. I speak to the vast majority of the top 100 or so kids over the course of the season, and top two interview for me without question, just in terms of the way he spoke, the way he carried himself, how his energy, his enthusiasm. He's an extremely sort of lovable kid, and I think there's something to that where they saw this skinny kid playing for the 67s who was from Austria and had a long way to go in terms of getting stronger and developing the rest of his game, but had some skating and had some sort of soft finesse skill. And on top of that, was just an awesome kid. And I think they felt that was reason enough to take him. So I'm always intrigued by that. Him and Owen Pickering, who was taken in the first round by Pittsburgh, were probably the two kids who most impressed me that way, just in terms of being able to sort of hold a conversation with them. So I think he, and I wasn't alone in that. I had multiple scouts text me after the draft that they were blown away by Roar's combine interviews and all that. So I think that was, it does feel like that was a little bit of part of the process for Montreal.
Yeah. I mean, I was at the draft, and after he left the podium, even while he was talking at the podium, I was just thinking to myself, like, this is probably one of the brightest hockey players I've ever talked to. And just to his, you know, he grew up playing tennis, and just his analogy to how tennis helps him on the ice is just really unbelievable self-awareness. And yeah, it's funny you mentioned that off the top, because that's exactly how I walked away from the first time I saw him speak as well, at the draft podium, which, you know, in Montreal, not an easy place to be, talking to that Montreal media for the first time. But yeah, it just, it definitely struck me as that. And yeah, like I said, you know, I don't know if he makes the NHL, but I'm not going to bet against a kid like that at any stretch.
No. Yeah, I agree.
I want to turn the focus a little bit back to the draft, to put you on the spot a little bit. One name, and I don't want to say that one name that you're higher on than everybody else, or that you think, just one name that isn't getting the attention that they should. And this doesn't have to be a first round prospect. It could be somebody who maybe goes, you know, much later in the draft. But one guy that you just really think is going to be a name that people are going to know that they might not know right now.
Yeah, that's a good one. One of my deeper cuts would probably be a Slovak kid by the name of Alex Chernik. Chernik is sort of a smallish kid, 5'10", 5'11", winger. Not tiny, but not big either. Played in Hockey Allsvenskan this year. He's on the older side of the draft, so he's a late 04, and this draft is obviously predominantly 05s. So wasn't at U18 Worlds, wasn't front of mind at the Hlinka-Gretzky Cup, wasn't playing at the sort of international U18 events throughout the year for Slovakia. And just, I don't think maybe got the shine that he probably deserved as a result, but was equally as productive in Hockey Allsvenskan as Dalibor Dvorsky, who we know is going to be a top 10 pick. Obviously I'm not saying they're the same caliber of player, but that's just, in terms of the relative production, he was a good player at that level. He had 10 plus points, playing, I think he had ended up maybe even closer to 20 points playing in Hockey Allsvenskan this year. But prior to that was a point per game player at the J20 level last year, which if you rewind a year in terms of saying, okay, he's on the older side of this draft, what did he look like a year ago? He was still a sort of top productive player at the J20 level in Sweden. Prior when he did play at U18s and at the Hlinka-Gretzky Cup was a sort of right productive at the top of his group, scoring 8-9 points in 5 or 6 games kind of every time he played internationally. I thought he looked good as a draft eligible at the World Juniors in Halifax, playing on their U20 team, and is just a really quick, nimble player out there. I wouldn't say he's the fastest player in the draft, but he was still on my top skaters list when I did my sort of draft superlatives, if you will, piece, which dropped today. And that's because of just how nimble he is on his edges and his ability to dart around and attack on angles, and a really sort of fun player to watch at that level, whether it's Hockey Allsvenskan or against his peer group in his sort of age group, if you will. And I wouldn't be surprised if he was a sort of second line winger someday. And if you can get that in the third or fourth round, where I think he's likely to be taken, that I think there's some value there. So not a surefire NHLer or anything like that, but he's got some skill, he's got skating. He's sort of a very tactile offensive player in terms of when he chooses to shoot and when he chooses to pass and how he attacks, and just a very sort of attacking, aggressive player inside the offensive zone. So I'm a big fan of Chernik and the way he plays. He's in the second round, sort of early second round on my list. Won't be picked there, but that's sort of where I have him slotted, and would not be surprised in the least if him and Dvorsky were having fun at the World Juniors together on the same line in Gothenburg in 2024.
Everything you've said to me just tells me that the Montreal Canadiens are going to take him. he played with Slavkovsky and Meshar in that U18 team a couple years ago as well. So, I mean, everyone was, leading in about, two months ago, everyone was saying, oh, the Canadiens are going to take Dvorsky in the first round, without even knowing where the Canadiens were drafting in the first round. But yeah, if you're looking for a Slovak that Montreal might get, circle his name, I think, because they seem to like that team. and they're scouts that watch the young Slovakians as well, right? So is there anything else that maybe we didn't touch on that you want to mention about this draft?
No, not really. I mean, the only other question as it pertains to Montreal is are they going to take one of the five or six top goalies? And if so, when do they pull that trigger? And the sense I got at the combine was that I don't think they're going to take Caraba, and I don't think they're going to, I just don't think they want to use that, whatever that first pick in the second round. I think they're 30, is it 37?
Yeah, it'll be fifth or fifth pick in the second round. Yeah, so
Yeah,
fifth.
so I'm not convinced they're going to use 37 on a goalie, but one of the strengths of this draft is that there are six, I believe, six sort of legit goalie prospects. It's the first time I've ever had six that many goalie prospects in my top 100. I normally have three or four guys, and this year I have six. So there could be a maybe not a true sort of number one, but there aren't many true number ones in the NHL, period, these days. Once you get past Vasilevsky and Sorokin and Shesterkin and a couple of others, right? So if he there are guys in that group, like I wouldn't be they're not all six of them are gonna hit, but I would not be surprised if two of Adam Guyan, Trey Augustine, Michael Harabal, Jacob Fowler. I wouldn't be surprised if you flip a coin on each of those guys and three out of those six or two out of those six become sort of good NHL goalies.
Yeah, it's definitely gonna be interesting because yeah, the vibe that we got at the combine is yeah, they talked to every goaltender who was there, mentioned that they spoke to Montreal, and obviously it's a need for the organization in terms of depth, and yeah, I mean if you feel that you need to have those two goalies because let's face it, there aren't very many Carey Prices out there, to be that number one goalie like you mentioned, so they're definitely gonna I think they're definitely gonna take a goalie probably earlier. I don't think with that second rounder, but once you get to the third or fourth round, or even once they see a couple of goalies go off the board, you don't want to, you want to maybe avoid that run and kind of trade up a little bit. I definitely think that that's the direction to go in as well. And it does seem like, even going back to the World Juniors, there were so many undrafted goalies who were starring for their teams. The Czech goalie, Thomas Sekanic is another one who will probably get drafted this year. As
Yeah,
well as,
Sukonik's going to be a little bit later, but
yeah.
certainly I think Guyan, the expectation is that Guyan's going to go in the second round, so
So Montreal has to go, if they want to stock up on Slovaks, they're gonna have to maybe get an extra third rounder to get Chernik and Gaudin, right?
I'd be super interested in Milic as a late round pick for sure out of Seattle. It's what, his second or third time going through the draft. He was really good at the World Juniors. I felt like he was quite good in the playoffs as well.
I do wonder with Milic whether because this is his third and final crack at it, whether teams almost play the risk game of if we can let him, if enough teams let him slip through, we can all sort of compete to sign him kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then we don't have to use a pick on him. That's always a conversation that teams are having when guys are in their third year. So I do think that could happen with him, but I could also absolutely see a team using a fourth or fifth round pick or whatever, and snatching up his rights.
Yeah, Montreal definitely doesn't shy away from drafting overage players. Raphael Harvey-Pinard, Xavier Simoneau, Tourigny, Norlander. There's a bunch of guys
Davidson.
that they've taken in their draft plus one or even later, and have turned out to be pretty important members of the organization.
Well, they love their late round steals. So there's one more that I want to throw out there, Scott, because you mentioned that the staff in St. John pretty well. I actually live in the area. I moved here last year. And one guy that I've been watching that I'm going to write a draft profile on him because I think he deserves to get picked, but I'm not sure that he will, is Cole Burbage. I was watching some of their games this year. Obviously, St. John, very struggling team. They surprised Gatineau by managing to take one game off them in the playoffs, but realistically, they were significantly overmatched in that playoff series. But Cole Burbage was a guy that actually impressed me a lot. He's got a lot of hockey sense. He's very well positioned. He's super tall and he's a beanpole. He's like 6 foot 1 and 160 pounds. Bit of an awkward skating stride, but I think there's a player there. And you probably know the organization better than I do. But I asked a few people about him when I was at games this season, and I was hearing from a lot of people, listen, this kid's going to be a lot better than people give him credit for. A bit of a late bloomer, had 50 points as a rookie this year. Have you heard anything good about him? And do you think this is a kid that teams should be targeting in those late rounds, that 6, 7 round area?
Yep, he's in the conversation there. Certainly was a good player at Mount St. I believe he went to Mount St. Charles prior, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so he was a good, if I recall correctly, he was a good player at Mount St. Charles, but took a little bit longer to sort of come through the ranks. The classic sort of Nova Scotia kid where the QMJHL draft can let some of those sort of Maritimes kids that play AAA in the Maritimes, and many of them then go south. We saw Jordan Dume and others have sort of taken a similar path where they'll play AAA in the Maritimes rather than Quebec. They don't get the same love for the draft, and then they sort of take a bit of a different route. Some of them consider going the college route, and then St. John definitely has an extremely impressive track record of recruiting kids away from the college route. I could list off 10 kids that have played for that team in the last three seasons who were committed to colleges, and somehow the Sea Dogs got them to come play for them. And Burbage is another one of those kids. So interesting one. I believe he's a younger kid too, like an August birthday. So there's the belief there that he's got more runway. He's got more room to sort of fill out that frame and could take a big step next year for that team and be a sort of top player on that team as they try to rebuild here. And there are some interesting qualities there. He's a pretty smart player in terms of just sort of the way he sees the ice and passes the puck and all of that. So there's something there. He wasn't on my list and wasn't among the, I did my top 100 and then 27 honorable mentions. So he wasn't in my top 127, if you will. But if my list had have run to 100 or 50 or 100 or 60, he would have been in that next group of players that I watched this year and was at least a little bit impressed in, kind of thing.
So I'm on the right track. So we'll get that profile in there, and then I'll make sure I mention that Scott Wheeler gives him a stamp of approval. So it's your fault if anybody drafts him. And
he may slip through, though. I think because of that team where they played, because of the work he still has to do, he may be like a development camp invite for somebody, kind of thing.
Yeah, I could see that 100%. I think he deserves a shot. It's just from me watching him, I was super impressed with him on that kind of a struggling team to put up 50 points. And the way he did it, like you said, with smart passing, just really moving the puck intelligently and being well positioned. I think that's something that, you know, particularly at 6'1", if the guy puts on some muscle and works on his skating stride a little bit, I think you're seeing a completely different player next year.
Yeah.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us. Enjoy the last stretch of this draft. And when you actually take a break, like when's the time when you can be like, okay, 2023 is done now. Is that after day two of the draft? Is that where it goes?
Not really, because we I'll then fly back home and we'll have free agency the next day this year because of the way right. that it's mapped out. I'm not super involved in our free agency coverage, but there's always a trade or two that also happens. And then there's prospects normally going one way that I have to do a little bit of stuff on for us. So don't really get the long weekend off there. The Canada Day long weekend isn't really a weekend off for any of us. But after that, I will try to, I'll try to squirrel away. I also have my drafted prospects rankings run each summer. So I'll have to, put that together. It's typically a top 50 players and a top 10 goalies that I do. And I'm sure everybody can expect that Connor Bedard and company will be at the very top of that. But then you've also got to include the Logan Cooleys and the Simon Nemeches and the David Juracek's and all those guys as well, right? So that'll be next on my docket. And then everybody kind of screws off at the Athletic in August. The content at the site kind of gets a little sparse in August because that's when everybody tends to take their vacation. But lo and behold, August is when the good people at Hockey Canada decided they would host a U18 tournament every year. So we'll have the Hlinka Gretzky Cup and the World Junior Summer Showcase in Plymouth, and it'll be right back at it. So I'll probably try to take a week off sort of late July.
And then you have your pipeline rankings, which everyone yells at you for, right?
Yeah, those aren't till January. Corey does his in the summer and I do mine right. in January just so we can kind of spread them out. So I've got right. some breathing room there. But yeah, that's always fun where I get smarter and smarter according to the fan bases as we get higher and higher in the list. So it's always a funny coincidence.
Perfect. Scott, thank you so much. You can follow Scott on Twitter at Scott C. Wheeler and obviously all his work at The Athletic. Thank you so much, and enjoy the, I guess, the fun time of the year for you, right? To see how everything goes in the draft.
Yeah, honestly, Nashville is going to be a lot of fun. We're there sort of Monday to Friday at the Athletic for a bit of a summit that we do where we get everybody together and do some meetings and that kind of a thing. And it's always a good party. I'm sure it'll be tough to follow up on Montreal last year. That's probably as much fun as I've ever had doing my job. But I think Nashville should be a lot of fun too.
Yeah, I Nashville is a great time at all times, never mind when they're hosting the NHL draft and everybody kind of congregates there. Again, thank you so much, and I look forward to seeing all your stuff heading into next season.
Yep. Cheers, guys.
Thanks.